From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. When we hear that homelessness is the most pressing issue in Los Angeles, that means all of L.A., not just downtown or Venice. Find out how the San Fernando Valley stacks up in the fight against homelessness. Plus, how an illness in L.A. once got so bad that entire neighborhoods...
They actually cordoned it off with rope. Only soldiers were allowed to bring water and food rations to each house.
It's ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Hope you're having a great Thursday so far. We're almost there. Friday right around the corner. Now, if you've been listening to our show this week, you already know we've been covering a lot of news related to global warming. It's part of a global initiative among more than 200 media organizations called Covering Climate Now, which aims to shed light on the biggest issue of our time. So today, we continue with stories about sea level rise along the Pacific Coast Highway and what can be done to slow it down. And we'll also visit Santa Monica, where a project is currently underway to create living dunes that can help combat coastal flooding. That's coming up in about 15 minutes, so stay right there. First, though, clean vehicles. Now, chances are, if you're listening right now, you're driving. And chances are also pretty good that if you're driving a car, it's running on gas. But let's say you wanted to make a switch to something more environmentally friendly, like a plug-in electric car, something that generates zero emissions when driven. Well, in California, there is a rebate for that. It's part of something called the Clean Vehicle Rebate Project, and it's available to drivers who either lease or buy a low or no emissions vehicle. Well, with all the wrangling between California and the Trump administration this week about who has the authority to regulate vehicle emissions, a bill that would affect those rebates is getting renewed attention. California Assemblymember Phil Ting is the author. Assemblyman, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you for having me.
All right, now, we've been waiting for it, and today the federal government officially announced it's a one national program rule, which would effectively kill California's right to set its own tailpipe emission standards. And yesterday, State Attorney General Javier Becerra vowed to fight it. Today, you're resuming your push for AB 40. That's a bill you introduced late last year. What would AB 40 do exactly?
So AB 40 would modify the Clean Vehicle Rebate Project to only subsidize or incentivize vehicles that were manufactured by automakers who signed on to California's fuel efficiency agreement. And currently, we have four automakers who have done that, two who said they will. They haven't been announced, and hopefully more will be following soon.
And the four are Honda, Ford, VW, and BMW. But wondering, Assemblyman, how is this not maybe manipulating the market when it comes to cars? And how is this not handing these particular automakers the market in California?
You know, it's not at all. We have limited tax dollars. We have a greenhouse gas reduction fund, and that fund's sole goal is to reduce greenhouse gases. Given that, we have to focus our money on the best way we could incentivize greenhouse gas reduction. Right now, transportation is 40% of greenhouse gas emissions. 80% of that 40% is from most people driving, probably your listeners right now driving gas cars, who are adding to that GHG in the air. So if we can not only incentivize somebody to purchase a car, but get the automakers to agree to produce cars that have lower emissions, even if they are gas cars, then that's a huge win for California.
You used the word incentivizing, but what would you say to someone that said, well, that's not incentivizing, that's dictating this market, restricting it even?
You know, I would totally disagree with that. We have, again, limited tax dollars that have to be focused. This is a rebate program where we set aside money every year, and every year before the end of our fiscal year, the money runs out. So anytime you have limited dollars, you have to make the most strategic choices. So if you can not only encourage someone to get into a clean car, but get into a clean car whose automakers have said that they're going to not only sell you that one clean car, but make all their cars cleaner, well, I think that's a huge win for the state and a huge win for the air.
How does the Clean Vehicle Rebate Program, a project, work right now?
The project works right now if you buy a certain kind of vehicle, whether it's a plug-in hybrid, whether it is a fully electric or fully zero-emission car, you get a certain level of rebate. I think it's $1,500 or $2,500 right now, and it's a flat rebate when you purchase that vehicle. I want to further modify it because not only do I think you should only have the manufacturers who've signed on to the program be eligible. I don't think we should be incentivizing plug-in hybrids anymore.
We're talking to Assemblymember Phil Ting. He's been speaking with us about AB 40 that would restrict eligibility for the California Clean Vehicle Rebate Project. Now, your bill also calls for a rapid acceleration in the number of zero-emission vehicles on California's roads. Last year, Jerry Brown signed an executive order calling for 5 million ZEVs by 2030, but your bill, AB 40, adds to that, calling for 10 million in just 5 years later, 2035. How does your bill help to achieve that goal?
Again, I think it's by not only incentivizing individual consumer behavior, by getting automakers and really moving them to try to manufacture cleaner cars and hopefully more zero-emission cars. We unfortunately don't have that many choices right now. The reason most people buy gas cars is 95% of the choices are dirty gas cars right now. So if we can get automakers to move quicker, more quickly, and you've heard Ford, GM, Volvo talk about electrifying their fleet, but if we can even speed it up even more, I think once people actually have that choice, they're going to move to a clean car.
But Assemblymember, one of the things we always hear from people about not buying an electric car or a zero emissions car is that there's not enough infrastructure in place to maintain it. In other words, there's not enough charging stations. There's not enough in place to have one make sense for their lives. So how do you plan to help there?
Great question. So most people who have electric vehicles right now, they charge at home or at work. If you think about how many people who currently have gas cars in those situations, they could easily move to electric without almost any difference in their lifestyle, because most of them will charge when they get home and they charge overnight, and unless they commute, you know, over 90 miles like myself, then they're not really going to have a major significant change. Having said that, I introduced a bill that got signed into law that California Energy Commission is doing a full study on what kind of charging infrastructure we need to build out. The Cal EPA also has a study right now that they're doing through our budget. Now, you got the money for the budget process, but how to get to really clean vehicles by 2040.
Assemblymember Phil Ting, he's been speaking with us about AB 40, which would restrict eligibility for the California Clean Vehicle Rebate Project to automakers who side with the state's tougher emission standards. Assemblymember, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's turn to the San Fernando Valley now, where LA City lawmakers approved spending $62 million on housing for homeless people. Now, that includes a controversial project in Chatsworth, where the new city councilman for the area, John Lee, tried to slow down its creation. But it highlights the struggle in trying to get homeless services off the ground in the San Fernando Valley. Here to explain, we have Chris Freed, Chief Programs Officer for LA Family Housing, which helps to build homeless housing throughout Los Angeles. Chris, welcome.
Happy to be here.
All right. Now, when Angelenos think of homelessness, some might think the problem is just concentrated in an area like Skid Row or maybe Hollywood or Venice. But what does it look like in the San Fernando Valley?
Homelessness is everywhere. Our numbers, specifically from the 2019 count in the San Fernando Valley, were 7,800 people.
In context of what this problem is in the rest of Los Angeles, is that a big amount?
It's an extraordinary amount that are sleeping outside or without a home. Something's wrong with this picture.
Now, can you calculate the needs of the area of Los Angeles? I mean, are there X number of beds or services that the Valley needs to specifically serve the homeless people that are there?
What I can tell you in terms of the actual need is way more than what we have right now. We do have a couple of bridge housing projects that are coming online. There are a few permanent supportive housing developments in the pipeline, both that LA Family Housing and other colleagues of ours are doing throughout the Valley.
Chris, to be blunt here, I mean, are there areas that really are not shouldering their share of this burden?
Absolutely. So, I mean, the west part, Chatsworth, Porter Ranch, Northridge, Granada Hills of the San Fernando Valley, for sure. And I think in what was Councilmember Englander's district has zero units of bridge housing or permanent supportive housing. So, yes, there is an absolute shortage.
And Chris, if these areas don't shoulder their share of the burden, what does this do to the rest of the areas that do have to?
First of all, it puts an immense amount of pressure on other communities to take the brunt of the burden, which is not the intent. The intent is we have a lot of folks in the San Fernando Valley that are from the San Fernando Valley that want to stay in the San Fernando Valley. They don't want to move to other regions. And so just because housing is built in other regions doesn't necessarily mean the people that we work with are going to move. This is their community. Why should they be displaced? What we need is everyone to step up and to build their fair share.
We're talking to Chris Freed, Chief Programs Officer for LA Family Housing. Now, last year, there was a lot of resistance to another homeless housing project in the Valley. That was in Sherman Oaks. Folks there in Sherman Oaks basically shouted down lawmakers who tried to defend opening up the facility. How do you combat those attitudes and try to get those neighbors on your side?
I actually happened to be at that open house. And yes, it was definitely a contentious spirit, if you will. But I think really what it takes is including the community in all of the discussions. And I think that that happens in multiple stages. It happens when the concept is first being proposed, and then you move that on to the design phase and you include communities in the design, I think. And then from there, you talk about how it's going to operate and what are the particular concerns that people in the community have, so that as you're planning out, you can build those factors in.
Politically, Chris, are lawmakers of Los Angeles committed to making sure that housing, services, and solutions are spread equally throughout the region so that everyone doesn't have to just shoulder it one area?
I definitely think from both the county perspective and from the mayor's office, from the city perspective, that this is their number one priority to solve. Definitely the members of the Homelessness and Poverty Committee have stuck their neck out within their own districts and have opened projects that were under incredible scrutiny from community members, but they stood up and they stood their ground and they followed through and they opened it up. When you start to build in the community input, then the community members have some portion of a say in terms of helping you design, then it meets everybody's needs.
Now, earlier this week, we had President Trump and his team survey the state, including our homelessness problem here in L.A., and they floated the idea of a federal solution where people are put into federal facilities, for example. But then again, they denied Governor Newsom's request for more federal money to deal with the issue. Generally, what do you think of what the president and his team are doing on this?
Really, I think the idea of opening federal detention encampments and criminalizing homelessness doesn't solve homelessness.
Criminalizing? Is that your understanding of what he's trying to do, criminalize homelessness?
I mean, whether it's actually truly criminalizing it, meaning that people will be thrown into jail or not, I think the idea from the people that we work with perspective would be that if they're being forced to go to a particular site and that they have no control over, I think we'll feel as though they're being put into some form of, that it is being criminalized.
So you'd almost not rather have that kind of help?
We know how to solve homelessness. Homes and homelessness, not moving people into some temporary solution that only prolongs the issue or exacerbates the issue. We have a really great system in place in Los Angeles and programs that work. What we lack are the resources that we need to truly solve this massive crisis.
So considering the lack of resources that you just mentioned, does the federal government have no role in this when it comes to homelessness here in LA?
I think the role is providing more resources into this community, and that there needs to be a commitment on the federal government side to increase the number of subsidies that we have to help support our most vulnerable neighbors.
So just to be clear, you do want the resources from the federal government, but just not their say on what you should do with them.
We as a community support what's in place that we already have here in Los Angeles. Up until really recently, the federal government also really focused on housing first, not criminalizing homelessness.
Chris Freed is Chief Programs Officer for LA Family Housing. Chris, thanks a lot.
Sure, thank you.
All right, one of the sweet perks of living in L.A. is taking a drive up Pacific Coast Highway from Santa Monica to Malibu. And if you happen to be in a convertible right around sunset, I mean, it's a postcard come to life. I mean, absolutely glorious. And aside from taking in the beautiful view, you're also thanking God or nature for creating it. One problem, though, that pretty picture could be changing, and not in a good way. Coming up, we'll peer into our coast future when Take 2 continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. All right, this next story you're about to hear is set well into the future. Now, you may not know this, but newsrooms often write obituaries ahead of time so that they're ready to publish when the person passes away. It's just how the news biz has always been. Now, what if the obit wasn't for a person? What if it was for a place that's been the home of some magical memories for generations? Ocean levels could rise by more than 3 feet by the end of the century, and that's going to mean many things that you love about our coast are not going to be around much longer. As part of our Covering Climate Now collaboration, KPCC science reporter Jacob Margolis thought it was appropriate to start prepping an obit for one of Southern California's most prized areas of Pacific Coast Highway, Santa Monica to Malibu. It's slated to run in 80 years or so, the year 2100.
California has a lot of places that represent summer to a lot of people. No place more than this secret spot. Malibu Beach, California, famous for its Malibu outriggers, surfing, and girls.
It was a long time coming, a slow fade. After more than a century of enjoying sandy beaches, waterfront homes, and pumping waves, it's time to recognize that one of the most famous stretches of California coast, from Santa Monica to Malibu, is a shell of its former self. Starting with the great Malibu surfing experience, which used to begin with that first step between the weathered Malibu wall, where all the surfers before you leaned their boards, hung out, and talked trash all summer.
I mean, I refer to the wall as the pearly gates of Malibu because it was literally like you passed from the concrete parking lot and then you stepped on the hot sand in the summer, and it was this sort of instant liberation.
Jamie Brissick was a Malibu legend and former pro surfer. Now, in 2100, the wall is gone. Erosion and encroaching sea levels made it untenable to keep. And the wave, well, this is what it was like in 2019.
Okay, here's a guy paddling, and he's taking off at first point. He's jumped to his feet. That feeling right there of gliding across that thing and looking at the wave, and the wave, because of the shape of the point, it's just going to keep holding up. He can ride that like almost to the pier. That feeling is one of the great joys in life, in my experience.
The wave wasn't destroyed, but the great Malibu surfing experience has been muted. The low tide is what the ultra-high tide used to be. The once great wave has been made mushy by the extra 3 feet of sea level rise over the past 80 years. The surfers wanted the wave to stay the same at all costs. That's not what happened. The sand that had flowed down and make the wave so good was disrupted when we put seawalls and rocks to protect houses and PCH. But it's not just the wave that we miss. Patrick Barnard with the U.S. Geological Survey was right when he said this in 2019.
I mean, these are very, very narrow beaches. They're already having lots of issues, and just a little bit of sea level rise, and they're going to be completely gone. I mean, I think in this case, it'll be, in a lot of cases in Malibu area, it's going to be sooner than later.
That's meant a complete loss of sandy beaches in many spots, used not just by surfers, but by people from inland trying to escape the relentless heat. There is good news, though. Wide beaches, like the ones at Santa Monica, have been maintained, meaning there's still some places to go and hang out. And since many of the houses have been removed along portions of the coast, the view from new PCH of the encroaching water is even more beautiful. While the Mickey Dora, Gidget, Endless Summer Malibu experience is not the same, just as we manipulated the rest of the coast, we regularly add sediment to try and save the surf spot. Second and third point, though, are gone. Something people 80 years ago were afraid of.
If Malibu was no longer the spot that we could all go to, we would be lost. For so many of us, this is our sense of community. This is our kind of respite or escape. And it's also we engage in this lineage of history by being here. And it's a lineage of a lot of happiness and people that have found in a densely populated city a place of great joy.
We were lucky. The estimates of 10 plus feet of sea level rise didn't come to pass. We didn't lose it all. But it all raises the question, could we have done more? And if we'd chosen another path, say, gotten rid of more infrastructure or homes, or even on the other hand, sacrificed more beaches or managed sand differently, what would that have meant for all the generations to come? Where will they find their pearly gate moments, where they take that first step onto hot sand, paddle out, and let go of everything back on land?
That climate change obituary for the Santa Monica to Malibu shoreline was written by science reporter Jacob Margolis, intended to run in the year 2100. All right, well, that was a bit on the sad side, but let's not despair too much. Instead, let's talk about solutions to dealing with sea level rise and how our coastal cities can adapt. And for that discussion, we got KPCC's Jacob Margolis in studio. Hey, Jacob.
Hey.
All right, so you might have bummed out a few people there. Is this all inevitable?
You know, we're already seeing sea level rise, and according to the state sea level rise guidance documents, we could see anywhere, depending on the emission scenario, from, you know, 2 to 3 feet for a high emission. They even say, like, plan for 10 plus feet.
Ooh.
Just in case, especially for critical infrastructure. But right now, and for our purposes, let's focus on, like, the 3 plus feet, which could definitely impact humongous parts of our coast.
Now, in your obituary for Pacific Coast Highway, you alluded to things that we could have done. Well, it's 2019, some 80 years before this obit's supposed to take place. So let's talk about what actions coastal cities should be considering right now. And the first thing that might come to mind to protect infrastructure is to build a seawall. All right, so what would that entail? Give us the pros and the cons.
Yeah, so cities need to consider whether they want to keep their infrastructure or they want to, say, move it somewhere else or get rid of it completely. And this goes for homes, too. And let nature sort of take its course. Seawalls are an option, although the California Coastal Commission is not about them. Because what happens when you stick up a seawall, it's like, boom, this giant barrier here. It stops sediment from flowing basically downwards onto the beaches and replenishing those beaches quite often, which they need to exist. One example I'm thinking of is Las Tunas Beach right near Topanga Canyon. And there are before and after photos of Caltrans like saving this little stretch of PCH. And it was this cliff that was being eroded by the ocean. They stuck these giant rocks there, which are called a revetment. And it completely got rid of all the sand at that beach. And so I don't know in what situation that beach would really be usable, but it did save the road above, and it could be saving some of the houses along that stretch as well. And that's just a small example of what we could see, you know, the big debate around for the rest of the coast going forward.
All right. So building the barrier could protect the road, maybe some homes alongside it, maybe for a while, but destroys the beach. So it doesn't sound like the perfect solution. Is there a way to keep the beach and protect infrastructure?
It's really tough to say. There are some places that are giving it a shot, like Cardiff Beach down south, that are creating these things called living dunes, which are piles of rocks, but they have sand on top of them. They're constantly replenished with more sand, and they have plants and things like that to keep that sand in place. That said, when I talked to some engineers, like down in Cardiff specifically, you know, some of these are just a temporary solution, and eventually sea level rise will become so great that we're going to have to adjust as we go along.
What does this mean, though, for the sea itself, the waves? Because in your obit, you're not only waving goodbye to Pacific Coast Highway, but also to surf culture. I mean, that's kind of what we're defined by.
Yeah, I was really interested in, I grew up surfing Malibu and Topanga surf breaks, and I was really interested in what sea level rise would mean for like those places. And I really drilled down on Malibu in particular. And what you're going to see is basically 3 feet of rise that could make it super duper duper mushy, which is not a great thing. However, when I talked to some different scientists, you know, the idea came up that it's possible that we could manage sediment in a certain way, that we could build up the surf break so that it is possibly more rideable even in the future. We can move infrastructure around it to possibly give the waves more space to move inland. But those are all really, really big projects. Mm-hmm. And whether there's the money or the political will to do stuff like that, it's a big question.
What about this idea of managed retreat? I've heard some coastal cities are thinking about that. Does that mean that homeowners basically just should consider moving away?
This is going to be a really, really contentious debate going forward. And there's no foregone conclusion as to whether homeowners will get to keep their spots along the coast or not. But what we're going to see is this battle between homeowners basically staying right up against the coast and the dissolution of beaches and the possibility that the public will not have access to these beaches anymore if we don't let kind of nature do its thing.
All right, so it sounds like the question is, what do we want to save here? I mean, the natural environment or properties? I mean, so ultimately, how will those decisions be made? By individual cities, or how's it going to look like?
It's going to be a big debate and probably, honestly, a lot of lawsuits. The California Coastal Commission is going to be heavily involved. State, local governments will be heavily involved. And even local developer groups will be involved. And I mean, even if there might be people that show up to city council meetings that could be involved. So it's going to be very contentious and intense as people come to terms with what our climate future possibly is, but we are going to have to make these decisions. And it is strange though, right? Because we have to make these decisions for stuff that could potentially happen 30, 50, 100 years out. We might not be around for that.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting thing to ask people to do, but it's clearly something that we're going to have to do for very important parts of our coast.
Anything else, though, that can be done to maybe delay or minimize the oceans rising?
As with everything having to do with climate change, anything that we could do to reduce emissions and stop the Earth from warming as much could potentially help. Although, you know, we're going to have to see how everything plays out over the next 20, 50, 100 years.
That's Jacob Margolis, KPCC science reporter, talking about solutions for how cities can adapt to sea level rise. Jacob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Just heard Jacob mention something called Living Dunes. Well, the city of Santa Monica is working on such a project with the Bay Foundation. It's being developed in front of the Annenberg Community Beach House. And if you haven't been down there in a while, you might be surprised to see what's growing on the shore. A 2-acre patch of sand is steadily rising. It's currently 2 meters higher in some areas. Dotted with native plants and supported by wooden fencing, actual dunes have been created on the beach. Researchers hope there'll be a more sustainable way to mitigate coastal flooding and sea level rise.
I'm Melody Grubbs. I'm the Director of Watershed Programs for the Bay Foundation. So we're actually on Santa Monica Beach right now. We're north of the pier in front of the Annenberg Community Beach House. And this is the site of a pretty innovative pilot project to evaluate and bring back natural dune systems to the beach. But it's also kind of a cultural experiment because people have never seen this kind of beach. So I think for the past 50 plus even more years, beachgoers to Santa Monica Beach have been used to these really flat, groomed beaches with no vegetation. But in actuality, that's not what beaches are naturally like. And this project is an attempt to kind of bring back some of that wild beach. So when we talk about coastal resilience and developing these projects that buffer against sea level rise, we really have this kind of green to gray infrastructure concept that we use. And so this would be an example of very green projects. So it's very natural. We didn't move any sand. We seeded with native species. We put up some sand fencing, interpretive signage for educational opportunities and so for the public. And then we kind of wait and see what happens. And so this area, because beaches want to normally have plants and dunes, it was a change in management style. They stopped grooming here. Instead, we just left it. The beach is a really harsh environment. It's very dynamic for plants and wildlife. And so a lot of the plants that you see here today that we seeded with, they're native California dune species. They're very drought resistant, but they also have really cool properties to trap and build sand dunes. So they trap sand and they build sand dunes, and then the sand kind of piles up and plants get higher and they keep growing up, and they eventually form these what we call dune hummocks, is what you can see here. And so we actually didn't move any of this sand. The sand has all been placed here naturally through the wind movement and the plants growing. The benefit of projects like these really green projects, is we can start planning for them now. We can try implementing them now, because over time the dunes build higher and higher, so they're kind of self-sustaining. And the other benefit is they're really cost-effective. So compared to a seawall, these projects are so much cheaper. And so when you're talking about trying to protect large expanses of the coastline, this could be a really viable solution. There's a few goals associated with this project. One, to evaluate these natural systems or natural softscape projects, as we call them, to buffer against sea level rise and coastal storms. Two, to provide habitat, because we do have a lot of sensitive species in the area, including the western snowy plover, which overwinters here. And three, to kind of enhance recreation for the community here. So this is providing people with a different type of beach experience, something they may not be familiar with here, but dunes are really resilient. And so as long as we're not kind of grading them over, they'll stick around.
Go to the water.
There's definitely a need to implement more of these projects up and down the coast to learn from them, with the hopes of eventually scaling up. And so one upcoming project that we have that's been in the planning phases and we've just finished the designs for is the Malibu Living Shoreline Project. And that's a different type of project, but still beach restoration. So the goal there is to enhance the habitat better around 3 acres of beach at Point Doom Beach and Zuma Beach. And so we've been working with Los Angeles Department of Beaches and Harbors to help spearhead that project. You know, I think that these projects are so important. The State Coastal Conservancy acknowledges that. They've been a big supporter of some of our other projects occurring on the coast. A lot of local cities, Santa Monica has been great at spearheading climate change and adaptation initiatives. And one of the things to take from this is that sea level is rising. We're going to have coastal impacts. And I think as a coastal community, it's really important to start planning for the future now. I think it seems like sometimes a human trait to react, right? When something happens, we lose our coastline. Oh no, what do we do? And seawalls can prevent coastal flooding, preventing the water coming in, but usually at the cost of the beach. This is kind of a matter of, do we want to keep our beaches? Do we want to keep enjoying them, you know, for future generations? And this is definitely a part of the solution.
By the way, we've got some pictures of those dunes on our website. It's take2.org, take2.org. All right, the number of unreported sexual assaults would shock you, make you angry, or just plain make you depressed. And that's because for many women, the steps needed to put an assault on the record can feel overwhelming. Coming up, simplifying that process. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. The LAPD has responded to more than 1,000 reported rapes so far this year, but there are probably many more. Experts say more than three quarters of sexual assaults go unreported. KPCC's Michelle Faust-Raghavan covers women's health, and she wanted to demystify the process for those women who, for one reason or another, don't feel comfortable reporting an attack. Michelle has written about this in her women's health column, Ladiest, and she joins me now to talk about it. Hello, Michelle.
Hi.
All right, let's start by talking about what support is available for survivors of a sexual assault.
Well, there are several links on the Ladiest column. You can find that at laist.com. And you can get information even from your smart speaker, and you can get that information.
Help is available. The National Sexual Assault Hotline offers free and confidential support whenever you need it.
So that's Siri. You can also ask Alexa, and you just ask, I've been raped, what do I do? And the sexual assault hotline that connects you right directly to them, that's run by RAIN. That's the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network. There's lots of information on their website. And locally, there's a lot of information on the website, Peace Over Violence.
Michelle, how did you come to choose this subject?
Well, you know, like a lot of LA stories and a lot of Ladies stories, we came to it from questions from our readers. Also, our colleagues, Adolfo Guzman Lopez, you'll remember several months ago, he did a story at USC addressing, talking to students who were addressing the George Tyndall scandal. Yeah. That was a gynecologist accused of assaulting patients. And he got a lot of questions from students. And so it became clear getting all these questions that many women don't know what happens when they report a sexual assault or what goes into a rape kit, what exactly it is. And many women don't know what their options are.
Okay, so you mentioned rape kits. What are rape kits exactly?
Yeah, so the rape kit is literally a group of bags and envelopes. They're filled with evidence that's collected. It can be debris, swabs with potential DNA evidence that's taken from your clothing, your body, by a forensic nurse. There's also a series of paper forms and photographs, and that's all collected during a forensic exam.
Now, Michelle, you also mentioned women not knowing about their options. So what are their options?
Yeah, if a person is sexually assaulted, assaulted, they can call the police or go to a doctor or go to an emergency room. Medical professionals are obligated by law to contact law enforcement. The person who has been sexually assaulted is not obligated to make a report, but medical professionals will call the police. Police can take them to a sexual assault response team center, and that's where you see a specially trained nurse, and they do that forensic exam. Joy Hart is the president of the Southern California chapter of the International Association of Forensic Nurses.
A big barrier for people to come in is they don't know what to expect, and they're worried that if they come in, they're going to get on a roller coaster they can't get off.
And so the forensic nurses that I spoke to, including Joy, they mentioned to me several times that everything about this process has to be consented to. If you go to a SART center, you have the right to consent or to decline any part of a forensic exam, and you have the ability to make or not make a police report. Also, there's even the option of doing a forensic exam without filing a police report.
What happens in the forensic exam?
Right. So first, there's just a lot of talking, and you have a right to a victim's advocate during the whole process. A nurse will ask what happened, so they'll know what they're looking for. They'll ask you about your medical history, depending on how relevant that is. And then there's a full body exam. Depending on what happened, there'll be more, scrutiny of different parts. And then there are photographs that are taken of injuries. Swabs or fluorescent lights will be used to detect bodily fluids on skin. And if it's consented to, along with all the other parts, there is an internal exam. And very importantly, this is all wrapped up with medical treatment for any injuries and medicine to prevent pregnancy and STDs.
So once the rape kits are done, they're collected, what happens to them?
So they go off to the forensic lab. LAPD has their own lab. The Los Angeles Sheriff's Department has their lab. LASD has a policy to test every kit that it receives. That's something that they enacted back in 2008 following a national scandal of backlogs of untested kits in evidence lockers. And statewide right now, there's some estimates of about 13,000 that are still in backlog. That's statewide, not just in any one part of the state. But we really don't know. We're not sure exactly how many are untested. It could be more, it could be less. But by law right now, law enforcement across the state are doing inventory of untested rape kits, and that's due to the state by next July. So then we'll have a better sense. Also, lawmakers in Sacramento just passed a bill unanimously that would require all law enforcement to test every kit within 20 days of it being taken to being filed. But that's right now on Governor Newsom's desks. So we'll see if he puts a signature on it.
That's KPCC's Michelle Faust-Ragubon. Again, you can get more details in Michelle's story for Laist. That's our women's health column on laist.com. That's laist.com. Michelle, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, ever notice at work when one person gets sick, sometimes that gets the illness ball rolling? Employees in one area start to feel it, the whole section of the floor starts to go down, and then upon realization comes containment, and hopefully the rest of the office gets spared. Now, that's on a small scale, but what happens when whole city neighborhoods get afflicted? That happened in LA once, and it got so bad the military had to get involved. Find out all about it when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. All right, let's turn back the clock. It was a warm September day, much like this day, 95 years ago, when an outbreak of the pneumonic plague first struck Los Angeles. What happened is the subject of today's Throwback Thursday, and we got to warn you, this history does get a little graphic.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
Julia Bricklin is a local author who specializes in California history. She's here to guide us through the terrifying history of the L.A. Plague of 1924. Hi, Julia.
Hello.
All right, so this so-called plague we're going to talk about developed over the course of a few months, but take us back to the beginning. What do we know about how and where it started?
What we know is that a man named Jesus Lajun was cleaning out his room at his boarding house and found a dead rat underneath the floorboards. He picked it up with his bare hands and dispatched it to the trash can and thought nothing more about it. But then a week later, he started coming down with some mysterious flu-like symptoms. He was coughing, he was wheezing, he was getting these funny welts in his groin area, and generally running a really high fever, like 104.
And then what happened? I mean, he had family. They were all around him.
Yeah, he had a lot of family, and he also lived in a boarding house, so everybody lived in close quarters, not just his family. Pretty soon afterwards, people who were ministering to Jesus started to get sick themselves. A nurse from down the street, a young lady next door who happened to be pregnant, some of his family members, they also started to show some really strange symptoms. Again, coughing, wheezing, really funny-looking, pus-filled blisters around the groin, and really high fevers.
And what part of L.A. are we talking about here?
Well, it started in a boarding house on what was Clara Street, north of what is now Cesar Chavez Avenue. It's close to where the Twin Towers downtown jail is now. It's roughly that part of Los Angeles.
And Jesus' daughter died a week later. Doctors said it was double pneumonia. I mean, neighbors were dying as well. I mean,
terrifying. Yeah. So initially, neighbors and health officials thought that this was a virulent case of the flu, perhaps pneumonia. They had no idea what was about to happen.
Now, at this point, I got to think that people are panicking, right? A little bit. People are just showing up to the hospital, making their way anywhere they can to get to a doctor.
Yes. And don't forget, these are immigrant communities. These are people who don't necessarily have a family doctor. They don't necessarily want to be at the hospital. This is still a time, even in 1924, where people only go to the hospital to die. So people are starting to panic, but don't forget, this is still a very encapsulated neighborhood. So it really hadn't reached the higher echelons of the health community yet.
But doctors had to be freaking out a bit, right? The doctors at LA County General Hospital, they had to be wondering what's going on. These people are just showing up.
Yes, I think they were a little overwhelmed. And I know in those early days, they still thought it was something that could be contained and it just needed to run its course. They still had no idea. It really would take a couple of weeks until they were really in the throes of the plague to understand just how quickly this was spreading and, in fact, that it was this ancient disease on Pacific shores.
All right, before we get to how pathologists identified this as pneumonic plague, let's get some history of the plague here in California. How did it get here and how did it spread?
Historians and epidemiologists aren't very sure about how it specifically got to Southern California, but they did know that they had had outbreaks in Oakland and San Francisco. The thinking is that a rat boarded a ship somewhere in San Francisco that came from China or some other country and then managed to get down here in a fruit crate or some kind of train, but probably through the port of San Pedro or Long Beach. It had never been seen in Los Angeles. And this was a big deal because remember, Los Angeles was still being touted as a healthful, sunny, safe climate.
Until those dirty rats.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. All right. So pathologists identify this as a horrible plague. Then what? I mean, how do they treat it and try to keep it from spreading?
Well, at this time, we didn't have antibiotics. Again, it's only 1924. Antibiotics are coming soon, but not at this time. What they did have was an anti-plague serum in the East Coast. So doctors managed to get it shipped from the East Coast to St. Louis and then
pick it up in St. Louis and hurriedly bring it back out to Southern California. Mm. By this time, however, the plague had already been running for about 3 weeks. What did stop the plague, for the most part, was quarantine.
Wow. Now, so that's what we're in November now, right? November 2nd?
That's right.
So what kind of quarantine happened?
So soldiers were dispatched to the neighborhood. They actually cordoned it off with rope, and they prevented people, cars and people, from going in and out of these neighborhoods. And in fact, only soldiers were allowed to bring water and food rations to each house.
That's like that Dustin Hoffman movie Outbreak.
That's right.
Where they just they use the military to keep everyone in that tiny town.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And it's like the movie Virus, too, where they had to keep everyone in one place.
How many people were quarantined?
Well, it was about an 8-block area around Clara Street, which was bounded by Alameda Street and the LA River, and Macy Street, which is now Cesar Chavez Avenue, and what is now Rondout Street. Macy Street Elementary School was included, and also a 6-block area in the county's Belvedere District was quarantined too. People there had attended the Clara Street funerals. So once it was recognized that they went to the funerals, they quarantined that area as well. We're talking about 2,500 people.
Oh, my goodness. And it's 1924, so I can imagine there's a ton of panic. I mean, what does a city look like at this time? Because if people are relying on media at that time, sometimes I would imagine misinformation was part of the game.
Well, unfortunately, the newspapers started to run with the information they were allowed to see, which was we are seeing large numbers of Mexican families in this part of town suffer from this disease. And we're also seeing policemen and military roping these people in. So we have to wonder, is it a Mexican disease? Is it something that we should be afraid of? Or is it something that their culture has brought in with them? And should we, in fact, stay away from Mexican people in general?
Now, this event is considered the last urban epidemic plague in America. That's according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. And yet, I don't think it's something people hear too much about too often. Why is that, Julia?
Well, I think, again, you're talking about a city that was undergoing rapid transformation. Los Angeles was still attracting large numbers of people to develop its real estate business, and people who wanted a healthier lifestyle. So they really worked to sort of downplay in the media how effective this plague was at spreading. But I think we also, too, have to give Los Angeles health officials the credit they deserve. They really had learned from Oakland and San Francisco and, of course, other areas in the world that to have an effective quarantine is really the only way you can stop this, especially if you're trying to keep it from spreading to the port cities.
Julia Brickland is a local author who specializes in California history. Julia, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two, I mean, you can't keep missing greatness like this. I mean, you just can't keep doing that. But if you want to know where you can get it, just go to wherever you get your podcast, look for Take Two. We will be right there waiting to be heard by your ears. You can also find us on social media. We're at Take Two. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.